I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The path to reconciliation is one of listening, learning, and growing together. A path that recognises the central place of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in our past and in our future. It is in that spirit that we acknowledge the traditional owners of the land and pay tribute to elders past, present, and future.
Welcome to Policy Forum Pod, the podcast for those who wish to dig a little deeper into the policy issues facing Australia and the world. Policy Forum Pod is produced by the Crawford School of Public Policy at the Australian National University. I'm Anna-Greta Hunter, and I'm here today live with my co-host, Sharon Bessel. Sharon, how are you?
Hi, Anna-Greta. It's really great to be here. We were just saying for the past, many years since COVID, we've been recording mainly online. But today, for the second time since 2021, we're actually live in the studio, which is very exciting. And we are also here today with a very special guest. In January of this year, I'm laughing a little bit as I say that because I can actually see all of you. So when people pull faces at me, I know what you're doing. In January of this year, Professor Genevieve Bell, who was smiling at me, as I said, we have a very special guest, was appointed as the 13th Vice-Chancellor of the Australian National University. Genevieve has had an extraordinary career as a cultural anthropologist, working for much of that career in the world of tech with Intel and developing the company's social science and research design capabilities. In 2017, Professor Bell returned to Australia to establish the School of Cybernetics here at the Australian National University. And yes, at some point during the conversation today, we will be talking about what cybernetics is. Professor Bell has published a number of books, including Divining a Digital Future with Paul Dowrish. And in 2017, she gave the Boyer Lectures, Fast, Smart and Connected, What It Is to Be Human and Australian in a Digital World. We are delighted to be joined by Genevieve today to talk firstly about her newish role as Vice-Chancellor of the Australian National University, her vision for the university and for the role of universities more broadly, and then to talk a little bit about her own fascinating research. Genevieve, so great to have you with us. Welcome.
Well, listen, it's lovely to be here. It's always nice to be in person here on Ngunnawal and Ngambri country, and I'm glad to be in the same room with both of you.
Genevieve, I have heard you say that you are the first woman to be Vice-Chancellor of the ANU, and we all know that, and that you are the second redhead. As another redhead, I have to begin this conversation by asking, who was the first?
Ian Young.
Of course he was. Yes, indeed.
And I imagine there were others, but I haven't had a chance to inquire quite so thoroughly. And all the photos we have of the rest are black and white. So while I can assert with, you know, a reasonable degree of certainty, first woman, one of the first social scientists, certainly the first anthropologist, I think the first person who'd spent time in industry, and then I'm going to claim second redhead because it's always good to be second at something.
Yeah, I love that amongst all of that, redhead is prominent.
Absolutely.
It's lovely to see if we can define the features that make one more likely to become Vice-Chancellor.
Well, certainly not being an anthropologist, as it turns out. In the history of Australia, there have only, near as I can tell, been two, myself and Jan Reid. Interestingly enough, both of us PhDs from Stanford.
Yeah, it's a really interesting skill to bring to the role, and I can't wait to have this conversation with you, bringing out some of this. Genevieve, you've been Vice-Chancellor of the ANU now for about 3 months or so. It's early days. We'd love to hear your reflections on what you see as the role of universities today, and in what in particular is the role of this institution, the Australian National University.
Can I turn that question on its head, Anna-Greta, and start with
this
university? Look, I'm acutely aware that stepping in as the Australian National University's 13th Vice-Chancellor it's a good Taylor Swift number, if nothing else, the 13th Vice Chancellor, is to assume a role in a place that has a really distinctive and particular history. And I sometimes think it's important to articulate what that is and to think about what the through line is from the founding of this place to its kind of its present and then its future. Look, being the national university in any country is a complicated badge to wear. I think for this university in particular, the reason to have a national university in the first place is really tied up with what we would now call public policy questions, but at the time was about a perceived sense that in the immediate aftermath of World War II, in a time when I think you could say there'd been a violent rearrangement of time and space and bodies and nations and ideas about democracy and freedom, where there had been genocides and an incredible kind of refiguring of the world, for Australia, which had been in that conversation, on the edge of that conversation, supplying that, I think there was a very clear sense that what came next would have to be both different than what had come before and in some ways more deliberate. And I think for the political classes in Australia, and certainly for the Prime Minister at the time, Chifley, there was an active sense that there was an opportunity to build Australia anew. And for Chifley, and I think for some of his colleagues, in both politics and government, there was a sense that while the war had been a violent rearrangement, it also made really clear some of the places that building and rebuilding would need to happen. It was a very clear sense that there would be economic transformation and that ideas about how economies worked were very different. There was clearly a sense that there was a new set of military capabilities and you'd want to have a viewpoint about those, if not participate actively in that kind of nuclear age that was emerging. There was a clear sense that transformations in medical research would make possible different ideas about life expectancy and society as a result of that. So, spoiler alert for the 1940s penicillin and, you know, what that would do. There was clearly a sense for Chifley and his colleagues that if you were going to have war, you needed to have things you were fighting for. And for them, that was about culture and society. So you should have a viewpoint on how you constituted that. I think for Australians in particular, the sense of what we didn't know about our region had become a very clear part of the conversation during the war. We found ourselves allied to a European power and dependent on an American one, but we found ourselves in a region that was neither of those, and how we had better awareness about that was obviously on Chifley's mind. And last but by no means least, I think for him and his colleagues, there was very much a sense that wars were also about ideas and we should be generating our own. And it's a fascinating to think about what the conversation must have been, that at looking at that index of what we would now think of as grand challenges, huge problems, North Stars. We'd have a lot of language for it. But at the time they went, okay, if those are all the things we need to solve for, where on earth are we going to find the people to have those conversations? How will we curate them? How will we ensure that we are pushing ourselves to get to answers we can do something with? And that part of the solution to all of that was to say, and what we need is a national university, is for me kind of extraordinary. And I'm lucky enough to have, you know, heard a little bit about what those conversations must have felt like. And when I think about the language that even the people involved in those conversations used to talk about it, right? So Nugget Coombs, who was a chancellor here in the 1960s and 70s, and who's an important architect, I think, of 20th and 21st century Australia. He says that at the time they were, what was his line, flush with post-war optimism, and that they really wanted to make a place that would take into account the context of the political, the economic, and the social space, and that a place like this would give us the knowledge with which to build wisely. And there's something about that conceit that I find extraordinary, right? That we would create a place that would build the knowledge upon which we would then rebuild Australia. And Nugget says that what he and his colleagues thought they were making here was what he shorthands as the powerhouse of social reconstruction. And I think that's an extraordinarily rich and fertile phrase, right? Because it suggests a role for this university and arguably for all universities, right? Which is that we need to be engaged in making and remaking the world and engaged in generating the knowledge with which that making and remaking can happen. And whether that's about educating the next generation of citizens, of critical thinkers and critical doers, whether it's about unearthing and holding the knowledge and sharing it through all the channels and mechanisms we can with all the people who need it, whether it's about curating the conversations, all of those feel like their roles both for this university but also for all universities. And then I think about, where does that legacy leave us in 2024 looking forward? And I think about this as the National University, and I think to myself, well, that problem statement of things that Chifley and his colleagues thought were important, most of them still are, right? We still need to have a point of view about our region. The nuclear question is more urgent and different in some ways, but is no less present in our calculations. What it means to think about economies in a late end stage capitalist kind of marketplace feel like those are still relevant. The medical space, yeah, pretty much. You know, how we think about and talk about culture and how we build assets into that all feel like they are urgent, albeit changed conversations. And then I'd add to that three more that feel kind of critically important too now, right? One would be about how do we think about the environment, climate change, and energy transitions, which feel like a bundled set of conversations that we ought to have both a point of view about and research about. I tend to think if the conversation in the 1940s was about what will penicillin do to societal well-being, I wonder about what AI will do to the same in the 21st century. So how do we think about that piece? And then last but never least, for me at least, I'm also acutely aware we're nearly 250 years into our journey as a colonial regime in this country and thinking about what the role of the National University is in a conversation about truth, reconciliation and justice feels like it ought to be part of the complex of challenges we tackle here at the National University. So National University, what does that mean? Well, I'll borrow Nugget again, right? It means to be a university of quality and distinction. Means to generate the knowledge with which the world builds wisely. And I think it should be to aspire to be a powerhouse of social reconstruction along a set of vectors that we hold as challenges for ourselves. And then what that means for universities more broadly. Look, I think universities are in an interesting moment in Australia and globally of working out what it means to be. You know, we've gone through a period, certainly in Australia and in many other Western countries, where the number of people who have university degrees has increased dramatically in the space of one or two generations. We haven't necessarily thought differently about what the role of universities should be, even as that has happened. The number of people with PhDs who are employed in the fields in which those PhDs come is less than it's ever been, and yet we are still creating new critical thinkers and critical doers. And so how we do that in a way that sets up all of those people to have successful and fulfilling lives and doing good work is a different puzzle than I think it probably was when I got my PhD a million years ago. And so I look at all of that. It's a very long way of saying, look, the role of universities is what they should be, which is a constant debate with themselves and with their ecosystems about where they provide value and where value isn't always being easy to deal with. I would like to be a good partner, but I think sometimes being a good partner is also asking hard questions and staging hard conversations. And for me, all of those are part of the puzzle. That's the long answer to what's it like 14 weeks into being Vice Chancellor. The short answer is email meetings and a slow, steady increase in things being more legible to me than they were when I first turned up.
Let's focus on the long answer because I think there's so much in that that's really interesting, maybe more interesting than emails.
Listen, don't knock email. It's an important message and I'm happier that it's email than faxes.
that is a very good point. But Jennifer, I think when we get caught up in the day-to-day of what we do within a university, we often lose sight of where all of this came from, the vision of a university, you know, that idea of bringing about transformation and transformation for the good, you know, that idea of optimism about what the world might be. And of course, when you map out that history, it wasn't exclusively, but it was very largely a product of male leadership. You're, as we already said, our first female vice chancellor. We also have a female chancellor. I was very tempted to ask you about the role of redheads, but I'm going to stick with women for a while. you know, arguably it's been a very long time in coming for the university to have two women in those leadership roles. I'd really love to hear your reflections on whether there are particular leadership styles that women bring, or is it more about diversity and a range of styles and a range of views?
Look, I'm always inclined to think it's actually about a range of views, where my lived experience as a gendered being and my lived experience as being female in the United States and in Australia, those are two very different contexts and it felt quite different in those places. I certainly have had the experience of being in an academic discipline that has a lot of women in it, and then a work environment that had a lot of men. And I think I've had a long time to sort of reflect on the ways in which we turn up in those conversations in similar and in different manners. And I'm inclined to think that class background also makes a lot of difference here, as does where you sit in the life cycle of your family's relationship to education, as does, you know, how old you were when you turned up in various things, as does the people who mentored and trained you. And I tend to think, for me at least, my gender is certainly part of how I have been seen in the role. And so there has been a surprising amount for the 21st century, or maybe not. I'd like to think it was surprising. Maybe it isn't. A surprising amount of commentary about my body and my embodiment. You know, I've been told vice chancellors don't wear jeans. I've been told vice chancellors don't wear sneakers. I've been told to do something about my hair, about my backpack, about my lack of appropriate degrees of humility and gratitude, about the ways in which I speak. I've been told to watch my weight. I've had an enormous amount of feedback that I do think of as being profoundly gendered. But I also suspect running through some of that is also a little bit about the fact that I'm not, as other people keep pointing out to me, a traditional academic. So it's also why you look a bit too much like someone who spent time in Silicon Valley. I have people routinely tell me I sound too American for an Australian. And so there's been a lot of, I think of it as feedback that really I suspect wouldn't have been heard by someone taking the job if they'd looked a little bit more like the vice chancellors of yore than me. So I suspect there's a way where, regardless of how I feel like I might turn up in the job, I'm treated a little bit differently because of that. And that's always an interesting thing of how do you balance it as graciously as you can under those circumstances, and as much of reminding myself that for a whole lot of my younger colleagues, my students, for them, they look at this and say, okay, if someone who looks more like me than not can do the job, then maybe there's room for me in that. And I tend to think of that as being part of the responsibility. But in terms of, you know, forms of diversity and how it shapes my leadership, look, I think in some of the ways I've been vice-chancellor-ing, if that's a verb, I was much shaped by the fact that I spent 20 years inside a large American tech company where I have an assumption about pace, as in things should move, my hands including it and the microphone. So I have an assumption about pace. I've been socialized into a big company that was really big on accountabilities, that was really big on tasks and deadlines and a sense that you should do them. And I suspect some of the ways I have felt different from my predecessors is as much about where I had been before than it is about my gender. Well, that and the fact that I insist on wearing sneakers. Shocking.
Sneakers, fantastic gear for a vice chancellor. And Genevieve, you've painted.
Once it is a large campus. Is.
Yeah, no, it's a good place to get your 10,000 steps, ANU. You've painted the most extraordinary vision of higher education and the role of universities, and particularly, I think, an inspirational one for this institution. Universities, of course, are places that can open people's horizons and contribute new opportunities and pathways at an individual level, and at the societal level can contribute to justice and equity. What role do you see for this university in fostering equity and social justice, both within the institution and then across society?
Yeah, such a good question, Anna Greta. For me, there's a couple of pieces of the puzzle there, right? One is, I think there's a role in the stories we tell the world because they make it possible, right? So it's not just what you do, it's what you talk about and how you talk about it. And I have reflected a lot in the last year, I think maybe 2 years of my life, that part of the role for me of senior leaders, any leader, is to be telling stories about the future that are optimistic and stories that are characterized by hope, but also stories in which the world is more fair, more just, more equitable, more sustainable. And I get that in Australia, it's really easy to be cynical. We are better at it than almost any other place on the planet. It's nice to come home some ways to that as a kind of a, just, you know, we do cynicism in a way that's really quite, yeah, it's special. But I also know that cynicism is easy and hope is hard. And I think that one of the obligations I at least feel as a leader is to be constantly working out how to tell a story about the future that feels like there is a path through and a path forward. And one that is about being more, well, fair, just, equitable, sustainable. But I'm also acutely aware if all you do is that, it's not sufficient. And so for me, I think the sort of the second piece of I take very seriously as my responsibility as a leader, and I hope others do too, that we're also obligated to make the present different. Like, you have to intervene in the present if you want a different future. And so those interventions need to be pointed and around some of those questions, right, about fairness and sustainability and equity and justice and hope. So piece of the puzzle number one, you know, what do you have to do? Well, I think you have to tell different stories, and I think you have to interact in the present differently as a result of that. Number two, more pragmatically, look, one of the things that I was really interested in when the university's accord document was released now nearly 6 weeks ago, so in late February, early March, I was really interested in the language of equity of access there. So for the accord and for the minister, I think there's been a real focus on how do we make it possible for there to be more access to higher education. And I take that as two things, right? Access for students into universities, but I also think it's about ideas flowing out of universities. The accord might not imagine that, but I do. I think, you know, equity of access isn't just who comes here, it's what we share and how we share it, right? So that it can't just be that things turn up in forms that are digestible inside a discipline. They have to, well, much like I imagine this podcast, be accessible to people who come with very different kinds of desires and points of view and be able to make sense of what they're hearing in lots of different ways. So that's an obligation on us to be more legible to a broader context. I have also been really pondering, though, in the notion of that idea about equity of access, a different piece of the story for me is also about equity of aspiration. So how do we say that it's not just about what you have access to, it's about what you aspire to? So how do we create a brighter set of prospects there for what it means to aspire to get to be somewhere, not just to access it? And I think about, again, the stories we tell about who goes where and what it looks like when they get there, and all the pieces of the puzzle there, right? So the ANU, like many other universities in Australia and around the world, does things like creating summer and autumn schools so that high school kids can come and see what this place is like, so the first time they turn up at a university isn't on day one of orientation, but that they've been here before and that they have that opportunity of imagining themselves in a physical and embodied way on campus so that it's a little less scary. And that may sound like such a trivial thing, but if you're not from a family that's had a lot of educational access or you haven't spent time on campuses like this or on any campus, it's incredibly daunting to think about how you would show up here, and it feels deeply alien. And so small interventions like being able to say, come and spend a week here before you even have to think about applying, is for me a way of creating both those pathways but also the capacity to have an equity of aspiration, if you want to see it that way. And then even more pragmatically, I've been working with our philanthropic arm at the university to create a new fund so that we can have a philanthropic fund. We're going to call it something incredibly novel, the ANU Fund, that is designed to help scaffold students when they come here so that we can make the place more accessible but also support students better when they get here. And we'll kick that fund off, I think, with an end of tax year appeal. So if you are listening to this and you are an ANU alum, there is an email coming to you from me in probably about 6 weeks' time, and I'll be really grateful if you read it and then click the button at the bottom. I know. Just, isn't that dreadful? I've now used your podcast to make an appeal. Terrible, terrible, terrible.
I was going to say open that email and respond, people, but that's kind of out into the advertising, isn't it? But I think it's all in a good cause, so quite permissible.
Thank you.
Genevieve, I want to pick up a little bit on what you were saying about the importance of stories, of critical thinking, of the flow of ideas and what we aspire to, and bring it back to a policy decision made a couple of years ago now that really worries me in terms of what knowledge we value. One of the very significant changes introduced by the former Morrison government was the change to university fees, with some fees increasing by around 117%, while fees for other degrees that were described as job-ready decreased. There's been some recent university done by the University of Melbourne that's showing, to date, not many students seem to be changing their degree programs as a result of those changes, but there is going to be a massive long-term effect in terms of debt, and that could be quite insidious. And you mentioned class before, and I think this is, you know, certainly from the young people I talk to, this is not an equitable reform in terms of the decisions people make about coming into university. But I think it also gives really powerful messages about what knowledge is and what kinds of knowledge we value or don't. And I'd love to hear your thoughts, if not around that policy specifically, about the nature of knowledge and what kinds of knowledge we really need to value in this country if we're going to aspire to that vision you mapped out at the start of our conversation.
Yeah, so two slightly different but related threads, right? That policy setting was clearly one that, as someone whose entire background is in the social sciences, I found interesting, to say the least, and complicated, to say the most. It's certainly a policy setting that was revisited in the Accord to ask the question of whether it was appropriate or had achieved the desired outcomes. I imagine it is a policy setting that government will continue to query, as I think they should. And the reason I say all of those things in some ways has to do with my own lived experience inside industry and in thinking about what it was that I was trained to do and where my career went, and about the companies I have spent time in and around and what they value in terms of their future employees. And then where I sort of sit in the conversation about new technologies, right? And I think one of the things that's incredibly clear about the world around us is that the ability to engage in critical thinking and critical doing turns up in multiple fields. And it turns up differently in different fields with a different configuration of theories and praxis, with a different set of canonical thinking. And in all the places I've ever worked, you end up with better outcomes when you have more different kinds of voices around the table. Though I was joking with a colleague of mine the other day. I spent 20 years in a big tech company. We never talked about being interdisciplinary. Wasn't a thing we fetishized. But when I look around any table I sat around, we had people from lots of different disciplines all the time. It wasn't, no one led the conversation with going, well, as a chemist, as a material scientist, as a physicist, to be just like, here's the thing, also this thing. And I think that thing over there would be really useful and we would have an argument about ideas. And the fact that we could have that argument was because we came from different places in the conversation and the kind of points of view we could bring to it were different as a result of that. And when I think about who we hired in the company I worked in, when I think about who my colleagues hire in a myriad of technology companies across the US and indeed in Australia, we, in all of those places, not only value a narrow band of what we would sometimes describe as technical skills, but a broader band of things that include critical thinking, communication skills, an ability to talk and make sense across disciplinary boundaries, a willingness to be as invested in the success of others as yourselves, an ability to generate ideas, not just critique the ideas of others. And I think about all of that and I think how extraordinary it is that I get to be vice chancellor of a university that last year passed a new set of graduate attributes and declared that from now on, our undergraduates, when they leave here with a degree, will be able to and will have been exposed to critical thinking, interdisciplinary activities, and First Nations knowledge. And I think that's actually probably a really good thing, because when we think about the kind of conversations and work and jobs and skills and hard things we will have to do over the next 30 or 40 years, those feel like foundational building blocks, regardless of what your disciplinary background is.
Genevieve is a cardiologist who works in climate change, who finds herself sitting here talking with a vice chancellor about the nature of education. I have an arts degree as my first degree, and the interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary and different ideas seem so fundamentally important. It's been extraordinary speaking with you about the nature of universities and knowledge, but we have to take a short break here. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Listeners, welcome back. We are here with the extraordinary Professor Genevieve Bell, Vice-Chancellor of the Australian National University. We've been talking about the role of universities and knowledge. And now, Genevieve, we'd love to hear more about your research and your ideas, the knowledge that you've created and contributed to. I'd actually like to start with some basic definitions. What is cybernetics and why does it matter to what we're thinking about and how we engage with the world?
Oh, Anna Greta, I have a terrible thing to tell you. It involves another story. I realise I just can't. I'm not good at answering things quickly.
You're in the right place. We love stories.
Okay, good. Because there's a couple of different answers to what is cybernetics. One of them is to say cybernetics is an invented word. And one of the things I discovered about myself about 3 years ago was that my entire career is just kind of signposted by invented words. The internet, electricity, typewriters, Frankenstein, cybernetics, boredom. You're like, oh dear. But cybernetics, made up word. But why it was made up and what it came to stand for are really important. And if some of you in the listening world are thinking, oh, I know that word, like, where have I heard that word before? There's a reason you know that word in the 21st century. It's because it's sat dormant in science fiction for decades. Sheldon in The Big Bang Theory occasionally talks about himself as a cybernetic being. The Terminator certainly did. It's in Douglas Adams in The Serious Cybernetics Company.
That's where I know
you
from.
Marvin the Paranoid Android. Yeah. Exactly. And your plastic plow who's fun to play with, you know, The Serious Cybernetic Company. So it's everywhere, right? It's sort of a term that hung around in science fiction. The question would be, you know, how did it get to science fiction in the first place, right? And so cybernetics as a term was coined in the late 1940s by a man named Norbert Wiener. And what Norbert was trying to do was find a term to describe a phenomena that he was seeing and a place that he wanted to work. And if you take yourself back to the 1940s again, right? So remember, in Australia, it's Chifley and Coombs and others who are taking that violent rearrangement of the world as a sort of a genesis point for this university. In America, that same violent rearrangement provoked a series of conversations. And those conversations started in the middle of the war and continued through to the end of the war and even after it. And those were conversations that were very much in the context of saying, okay, there's a lot going on. Things feel deeply contested. There's a contestation of ideas and of power. And in all of that, there is an emergent role of technology. And in the latter stages of the war, computers went from being people who did numbers, mostly women, in fact, to being electronic objects that you could program. And those computers at the back end of the war could do things that humans could do, but tens of thousands of times faster. And the possibility there of something that could do a thing that a human could do, but so much faster than that, felt a little bit like earlier stages of the Industrial Revolution, but radically different from it, because unlike those earlier stages of the Industrial Revolution, where the thing the machine had done was replace a part of our body's capacity to work, this appeared to be our mind's capacity, because those computers were doing mathematical functions, basically, and much faster than a human could, and with a degree of accuracy that was kind of, well, it had been unheard of until that moment in time. And for a whole collection of people, they wondered what a world would look like if computers could think. And the language around computers led that conversation to be a pretty obvious one, right? We've been talking about the giant brass brain was one computer that sat in New England. There were others. There were electronic brains. The whole language and kind of, you know, semiotics around computers lend itself to that question becoming very kind of top of mind. But for a whole collection of thinkers, mostly in New York, really, in the second half of the 1940s, it was this conversation about what would happen if computers went to scale and if that bit about doing maths became a bigger thing than that. And for the collection of people around those tables, that was an extraordinary proposition. And the people around the table are well vested in some ways to have that conversation. You have John von Neumann, who was the architect of the ENIAC, so the first, you know, really successful early computer. You have J.R.D., Licklider, who is the man who would invent DARPA, so the thing that would give us the internet. You had Claude Shannon, who was the CTO at that point at Bell Labs, who would go on to create, you know, some of the earliest kind of systems and networks. You had philosophers from Harvard and Yale. You had a neurobiologist from Mexico. You had a linguist and a semiotician from other parts of the world. And you had Margaret Mead and Gregory Bateson, so the two most important anthropologists in the 1940s, all in this conversation. And the conversation was really about what is the world we are going to make? And if computers have been used to accelerate the destruction of humans because they were aiming guns, what else are we going to use them for? And what would it mean to say we should make a decision about how all of that unfolds and who should be at the table to make that decision and how do we have that conversation? There are lots of conversations going on. And into all of that comes a man named Norbert Wiener, who is a mathematician. And Norbert is really interested in what is the mathematical grammar or language you need to describe the relationship between computers and the people who use them, specifically when it comes to using them to augment human activity. And he was starting to think about it as a what he would have described at the time as a feedback loop. And we now use the word feedback all the time, but this is its first real usage. And it was to describe what happens when you make a calculation, have a human do a thing, and the thing happens. And he looked at that as a feedback loop, right? It was moving multiple pieces, the human, the technology, the place it was happening, and that there was a mathematical equation you could write to describe all of that. And he discovered that if you had a level of abstraction that way, a mathematical formula, he thought that that was a model that would explain the world, which is pretty heady business for a mathematician. But he also realized you couldn't run around explaining to people maths was going to get it done. And so he realized he needed some language for it, right? And he'd written a whole book about it, what he was calling systems of control and communication. So how were humans going to engage with these new computational objects, right? What would be the nature of our relationship? And he thought that relationship would be one about communication and control. But he's looking for a word to hold all of that. And Norbert was a lot of things. One of them was a child prodigy, and his dad had been a linguist. And so he'd learned a lot of languages as a kid. And one of the languages he'd learned was Greek. And in Greek, the word kybers means to steer or control in two ways. Hugely important for your podcast, I realize now. To control in one way, specifically about how you control a boat. And so think about a little boat for the Australians on the line. Think about a tinny, like a very small boat, where you know as you move the till or the rudder, the boat moves, but you can feel the water against the boat and your body and the till and the boat and the water make a whole system. And you know every time you course adjust, there'll be a little bit of adjustment from the water and the boat, and it'll be a constant act, that steering of making the boat move. And kybers is that. Kybers is also the word for how you govern a political system. Like, what is the feedback loop for governance in that regard? And so we took that Greek root word and turned it into cybernetics, the notion of how you governed or controlled or steered a system that had computation at its core. And so one version of what cybernetics means is it is the theory of systems and of complex systems with computation at their core. And for me, the piece that's so intensely interesting and valuable in the 21st century is an ability to think about what is the relationship between the human, the technical, and the ecological, and to think of them not as individual pieces, but as a thing in a relationship, and how we both characterize that relationship and imagine that there might be multiple places we need to engage in that system and multiple ways that we need to think about how the feedback works there is a degree of sophistication, I think, about imagining what our relationships are with technology that feels very modern, doesn't just feel like it should have been left in the 1940s. And indeed it wasn't. So Norbert and his colleagues have these mad conversations in the 1940s under the banner of the Macy's cybernetics conferences. And they do sound like they were really quite something else again. Like, I see the photos and I go, damn, there's a conversation I might have liked to have been in. And Mead says years later, it was like nothing else we had ever done. Just like, we'd none of us had ever been in conversations like that. It was really quite something. And she's still talking about it 30 years later, right? So you know it must have been a thing. But a bunch of the people in that conversation leave the conversations in New York and turn up 2.5 years later at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire in 1956, where they have a conference that coins the term artificial intelligence, and where they go from talking about a theory of the relationship between the human, the technical, and the ecological to litigating, what is the line? The study is to proceed on the basis of the conjecture that every aspect of learning can be so precisely described that a machine can be made to simulate it. And so you go from thinking about a system of feedback and relationships between the human, the technical, and the ecological, to going to a problem statement where all you are attempting to do is so precisely describe how humans learn and the intellect functions that a machine can be made to simulate it. And I think about what gets lost in that move from cybernetics to AI. The human, the system, the environment, the relational aspect, the notion that it was a whole, not a single piece. And I think about what it is we keep having to inject back into the conversation about AI. The human, the ecological, the system, the feedback loop, the mess. And I understand what the seduction was of that 1956 framing, because it's very tidy. And I think about where that conversation has taken us from 1956 to now. And the reason I want to keep bringing cybernetics out of science fiction and put it back into the university is I feel the urgency of that conversation is undiminished.
Genevieve, there's nothing like a good story to help us to understand complex histories and complex ideas, and you've just done that beautifully. And, of course, one of the frustrating things about human beings is that they're very messy. The world we live in is very messy. So tidiness might be appealing, but it doesn't work.
Oh, listen, Sharon, as an anthropologist...
Except in our offices.
I was going to say, as an anthropologist, mess is my favourite thing because it's like deeply revelatory. I mean, I sometimes live in it too, but you know, there is a bit where I'm like, no, the tidying up is also deeply revelatory, right? When we tidy up in that sense, both theoretically and in terms of an epistemology, like what gets tidied up and hidden in that sense is profoundly revelatory of where the discomforts are, of where the seams are, of where the work is that is still to be done. And there's something for me, and it has been where my colleagues and I have been working for the last sort of 4 or 5 years now, is by trying to bang AI up back against and reunite it in some ways with all of its messiness as a way of saying these conversations are hardly finished. And, you know, where are all these pieces that we might want to kind of reveal again? And what do the silences tell us as much as the presences?
As we have those conversations about how we tidy and what we tidy and where we take either artificial intelligence or cybernetics, which I think is perhaps a better way of putting it as you've explained it, how do we have those conversations in a way that is A, ethical, but B, picks up on that point you made earlier about the importance of ideas flowing out of a university and perhaps flowing back in. And those conversations, I mean, oh, to be involved in a conversation that Margaret Mead's still talking about 30 years later, you know, that's phenomenal. But the way you describe them, they are understandably quite elite driven. How do we, or at least driven by people who are experts in their field, how do we have those conversations today in a context where we're often prioritising lived experience and conversations outside of our area of expertise? How do we, or perhaps can we, have those conversations in a really participatory, democratic way?
Gosh, there's so many things there to unpack.
Yeah, I said A and B, but it probably goes through to Z.
All the things. Look, I think part of it is about how we make spaces for those conversations. And in the 40s, not all of those people were as expert as they became, right? So, but I think part of what made those conversations interesting, and indeed made the ones in 1956 interesting too, right, was the convening power of a conversation. And I think the fact that people were inviting each other to a debate and to a conversation matters. And in both instances, what Mead in one place makes clear and Minsky and the other, is that you can't invite everyone to a conversation and expect everyone is going to turn up on the same page in the first moment. And so what Mead and her colleagues make so abundantly clear is that to hold people in a hard conversation takes months and years. Because in some places you've all got the same word for different things, or you've got different words for the same thing, or you have a theoretical construct that rejects the thing that this other person is deeply preoccupied about, or captures it and uses it for a completely different idea. And just, I mean, I'll give you a really tiny example. When I first turned up at Intel a million years ago, I was in a conversation and people were like, really need to talk about power. And I'm like, oh, yay, we get to talk about power. So exciting. Because I think we're talking about social power. And then in the room, there's someone who thought we're talking about electricity. And there was someone else who thought we're talking about the power of a microprocessor. Those are three very different forms of power. But if all you say is, I'm really interested in power, yes, me too. We really need to work out how to structure it better. Yes, we do. We really should worry about whether it is flowing correctly. Yes, we should. It took us 15 minutes to work out. We're all using the same word to articulate entirely different things. And we could, in fact, have that same conversation without even getting to ground on the fact that the term carried completely different resonances for all of us in the room. And I think one of the things we undercall when we say we want to have these conversations is how much work we actually need to do to make the space for them to happen and then curate them over the amount of time they will take. We can all talk about the fact that we're in interdisciplinary projects, but I guarantee you part of the first thing we had to do there was work out how we trusted the other person, was work out how we found a shared vocabulary space we could all co-occupy. And then for me, and I always find this an interesting challenge, how do we agree that in occupying that common space, what we're actually agreeing to do is create something new, not litigate our disciplinary boundaries? And that means being willing to give up, walk away from, or park a certain set of disciplinary privileges that come from holding fast to a place you were trained. And I think that's really hard to do when we have structural systems that validate certain kinds of knowledge, where we have ways of being and making sense that reify certain kinds of disciplinary practices, that reify certain kinds of language, jargons, hierarchies, forms of intellectual production, quote unquote. And I think, you know, the challenge in saying how do we have conversations that bring other people along is about how do we all do the work to be going along. And I think there's lots of systems that make that really hard, right? The choice to be someone who works at the interdisciplinary seams is a choice to be constantly vulnerable. It's a choice to say, I'm going to eschew certain kinds of rewards and recognitions in the service of doing this other thing. And that's a hard choice to ask people to make. I've talked to some of my students over the years who've said to me, I really want to be this interdisciplinary thing, but, you know, it's really hard. And I say, yeah, look, here's the thing. If you're an interdisciplinary person, every conversation is an opportunity to reintroduce yourself, but also a burden to do it. And if you're in a disciplinary space, every conversation, people already know exactly who you are. And there's comforts and restrictions in both of those things. But I suspect when we say we want to bring people along in those conversations, we're undercalling both what it means to stage those conversations, what it means to have people in them, and how we acknowledge the work it is to have them and do that. And then we're doing all of that in a context where it's easier not to, in all kinds of ways, right? And when it's easier to use all sorts of shorthand, I can't begin to tell you how many people I have to explain to in any given week that the robots are not out to get them, and how many times we have to go through why that may or may not be. And I think that's partly because it's easier to manage in a shorthand, and we're not very good at taking the time to unpack that, because that's also work.
It's the time to unpack. It's the time for these conversations. And one of my miniature mantras for this year is to think about changing the world one conversation at a time. And for this podcast to introduce a conversation like this to the world is such an extraordinary privilege, a conversation which is deep in its curiosity and its respect, its caring. Genevieve, we often talk on the podcast about the importance, the deep value of care. And I'm struck, having heard you speak publicly now on a few occasions, about the way that you center ideas of caring and nurturing. Where do you see these ideas, behaviours and attitudes of care and nurture in our present and imagining what our future might be?
Oh, so interesting. One of the things I always think about when I think about what the cybernetic unfolding over the last 70 or 80 years can tell us, right? We tend to sort of think about a couple of things, my team and I, over the years. We've said, look, it's about how do you encourage a kind of plurality of voices, right? But knowing that those voices bring with them work. We used to shorthand that in the school as productive discomfort, that it's about how do you hold people in that moment of attention of ideas, knowing that it will be discomforting, but knowing that sometimes that discomfort is generative. Not always, but sometimes. And if you scaffold it right, it can be. I also think about why it is that we need to have time and that some things don't turn up on the first pass, right? And most of us know that. Your first response to things isn't often, sometimes a good response. It's not always your best response, and it's not necessarily the best platform from which to have the next idea. So there's something about unfoldings over time. I think there's very much this piece about how do you have a clear point of view about why you're doing things, about what the conversation is for, about what the end state is. And then I think there is this very strange term that it was very weird to be in a college of engineering and computing and talking about this last thing. Because I used to say to my colleagues and my students, look, I think the other thing the history of cybernetics teaches me, at least, is the importance of the idea of grace. And that what you need to do is create something, an idea, an intervention, a point of view, a thing, policy document, a paper, a book, whatever the thing is, right? And you need to hold it tightly enough that it has some shape to it that continues after you, but not so tightly that it stops anyone else from taking it and doing something new with it. And that requires being willing to know that you're not the last person that'll ever touch someone or touch something or do something with that. And that requires being able to know what your contribution is and be able to make room for others. And for me, nurture and care is what you said, and I tend to think about grace and generosity.
Professor Genevieve Bell, grace and generosity is the perfect note on which to finish this conversation. It's been an extraordinary conversation. I've loved it. I know Anna-Greta has, and I think our listeners will love it just as much. Thank you for joining us, and please promise that you will come back and continue this conversation and these big ideas that we've started to engage in.
I would be delighted. Ask me about year two.
Done. This podcast is produced by the ANU's Crawford School of Public Policy. If you liked this episode, please don't forget to subscribe to keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're feeling generous, please leave us a review. We love hearing from our audience, so please reach out to us on the Crawford School LinkedIn page or by email at policyforumpod@anu.edu.au. Our thanks to Hannah Scott for production, Jamie Kidson for sound engineering, Darcy Brumpton and Alex Jackson for the background research. From me, Anna-Greta Hunter, I look forward to seeing you next week.
And from me, Sharon Bessel, it's bye-bye for now.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.